Welcome to TechnoViews, a new series of interviews with major figures in the humanities and social sciences on topics at the intersection between science, technology, and society in the 21st century. My name is Gonçalo Santos. I am an anthropologist of China, and I will be moderating this episode together with my colleague and fellow anthropologist, Jun Zhang. In this episode, we are delighted to have renowned anthropologist and science studies specialist Susan Greenhalgh to talk to us about her latest book, So the Science, Making the World Safe for Coca-Cola, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2024. This book takes the readers deep inside the secret world of corporate science, where powerful companies and allied academic scientists mold research to meet industry needs. Susan Greenhalgh is the John King and Wilma Cannon Fairbank Professor of Chinese Society Emerita at Harvard University. She is the author of Just One Child, Science and Policy in Deng's China, and Cultivating Global Science, Global Citizens, Population in the Rise of China. Professor Greenhalgh featured in our podcast before for the book, Can Science and Technology Save China? An edited volume that she and Professor Li Jiang co-edited. Welcome again, Susan, to TechnoViews.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, your book deals with very important issues in public health, things like sugar intake, obesity, corporate interests, and science. You provide a critical examination in the book of what you call the soda science or product defense science. Can you explain to us what these are?
Yes, this term, product defense science, is an incredibly productive term that comes from the field of public health. Product defense science is science that's created not to find the best answer, the best solution to a particular problem, but to defend a harmful product from critiques of mainstream researchers. It's one class of corporate science. So soda defense science, or also soda science, is created to defend sugary soda from arguments that soda is a major contributor to rising obesity rates and therefore should be regulated and taxed. Soda science has protected soda by advancing two main claims. First, that exercise is the priority solution to the obesity problem, not diet, but exercise. And secondly, that soda tax and other governmental regulatory measures are simply not necessary.
I see. So, I mean, in a way, what you're saying is you're developing a nuanced argument about corporate science in general and soda science in specific. It's not simply that corporate science, soda science, is bad science, but that it's distorted. And but at the same time, it is a kind of science. So why does taking the science in corporate science, soda science, seriously is so important? In which ways does this approach help us move beyond earlier criticisms of the big food sector and its efforts to distort science for corporate benefit?
Yes, this point is so fundamental to my work, and it comes right out of insights from the field of science and technology studies. Most of the folks who've written on big food and the rise of the obesity epidemic, they look at what I call soda science, and they just dismiss it as bad science. In other words, unworthy of any attention. And so they miss a golden opportunity. It is bad science, but it also is science. It mimics science in every possible way, created by well-known scientists, published in major journals like Science and Pediatrics. But we need to take the science seriously because its science-ness, that is the claim that it is legitimate science, is what gives it its power in the world. What we should do is we should turn the question around and ask how corrupt scientists, like soda scientists, make their science appear upright, good, and correct. So how does it establish its credibility? What advantages do they gain by calling their work science? So, in other words, taking the science seriously allows us to see exactly where the science was corrupted, who corrupted it, and how, opening up answers to a whole host of questions.
This is a very fascinating research. But as you mentioned earlier, so does science advocates that to address the issues of obesity, physical activities or movement is the key, or as you put it, exercise is medicine. But let me just be a bit of a devil's advocate here. There's nothing wrong about emphasizing the importance of physical activities, isn't it? So what is the problem then?
Good question. So physical activity absolutely is critically important for health generally, and it's also very important for weight loss. In the calories in, calories out model, that still stands. But two big problems. First, diet or caloric restriction is more important than exercise. And secondly, exercise alone, which many people try to lose weight, absolutely doesn't work. This is what a large body of research shows. But also, it gets more interesting if we look more closely at it. The core notion in soda science, namely the figure of the self-calculating, weight-managing, calorie-counting citizen consumer, that is, the existence of such figures not supported by recent research in evolutionary biology of all such fields. So the claim of soda scientists is that an individual can count calories in through eating and calories out through exercising, and therefore manage their weight and stay at a healthy weight. But that's really not true. Research with hunter-gatherers in Africa shows that even hunter-gatherers who are engaged in 6 hours of intense activity all day long, they do not expend more calories than people who sit in office towers in New York and Paris. The body adjusts. What that says is that we cannot manage our calories out in a way that's going to allow us to keep our weights healthy. So the whole notion of soda science is really flawed.
Well, your research actually reminds me of some of the very important issues in our academic life today. So many academic institutions and or their governing agencies have stipulated something now called impact or knowledge exchange in the process of evaluating the performance of the institutions and scholars. For example, here in Hong Kong, when we write our grant applications, we have to have a section called Pathway to Impact. One of the ways to show impact or knowledge exchange is to show how one's research could be converted for industrial or commercial use. However, your book talks about the risk of corporate sponsorships or the collaborations between scientists and big companies, despite the existence of ethical guidelines. How or why is that case?
Yes, we have the same kinds of criteria in National Science Foundation applications. I remember filling out many of those. And the fact is, if the development of commercial gadgets comes after the science is done, there's no problem there. That's fully acceptable on ethical grounds. The problem arises when corporations are involved earlier in the process, that is, in the making of knowledge themselves. So, in principle, if the corporate role in making knowledge is fully disclosed, there should be no problem. But in practice, it almost never is. You'll often see at the end of an article, for example, disclosures of conflicts of interest. But rarely, if ever, does the scientist disclose that he or she has a conflict of interest. Often they say, I have no conflicts, but if you look really closely, actually, they do have a lot of conflicts. Also, those ethical guidelines that you mentioned, I look very closely at a set of ethical guidelines that was created about 15 years ago by the organizations involved in soda science. 10 major food companies were involved in developing them and certifying them. If you look closely, actually, there are no major demands on the corporations to restrict their behavior in any way. So it's like a fig leaf, it's like a whopping, we say in Chinese, where it looks like the ethical guidelines have been met, but in fact they haven't. So this is really an ongoing and very serious concern in many fields of science. In some fields, like the field of nutrition, which includes soda science, it's been the custom for decades that the food industry is deeply involved. And so many of the leading figures in nutrition science today still continue to believe that food industry funding is necessary and fine. It's really only a tiny push from an anthropological point of view. That's shocking and just so unethical and unacceptable on the face of it. But the people in that field find it normal. And the number of critics within the field of nutrition science are few and far between.
Interesting. But
Oh, can I just
let's
add
switch. Sure, please.
So the risk is that the corporations will influence the questions asked, the methods used, and the interpretations of the findings. That may be obvious, but it might help to articulate it also.
Let's shift the topic a little bit. Let's talk about politics. Here's a quote in your book, quote, "To see how scientific policy making worked on the ground, I viewed science not just as content, that is, numbers, facts, arguments, the conventional approach, but also as a human and eminent political process. A key phase in the making of policy scientifically involves identifying the science that will inform policy making and certifying its quality," unquote. This is a quote on page 252. It's such a fascinating argument. In making this point, you contrast soda science in the United States with soda science in China. Can you elaborate on this contrast? What can we learn from taking the analysis of soda science to China?
Right, so my argument is that when science is involved in policy making, a key step is figuring out, okay, which science is the best science to use in policy making? People very rarely articulate that and even worry about it. It's often just taken for granted. And that contrast you mentioned between the US and China brings out the importance of this very clearly. In the US, science, it's a democracy and science is open to the same sorts of democratic values. Science is lively and scientists are argumentative and science is agonistic. So people are all different gangs, different groups of scientists are always trying to press their ideas and gain converts and fight the opposition and make sure that their own science gains headway. In the US, soda science was a very minor body of thought. This soda science that went to China, it actually was a very minor body of thought. And many of the mainstream scientists knew that these scientists who went off to China were corrupt, but they didn't do anything. They didn't say anything. They just said, I interviewed them and I said, well, what's the deal there? What do you think about what those guys did? And they said, well, they have what they think is right, and I do what I think is right. And so it's a pattern of non-intervention in each other's science, which is not how science should work. But anyway, it's very contestatory in the US and China. It's quite different. In China, the political culture is hierarchical, it's leader-centric, and nobody questions the leader. People above the leader in the hierarchy, like top officials, they have good guanxi with this leader in the field of, let's say, chronic disease. So they wouldn't question that person. They have long experience. The followers under this head of the chronic health science, let's say, they dare not question him or her either. So when the central figure in the China story, Chen Shouming, when she introduced a single science of obesity to the entire chronic disease community in China, and she called it the best of international science, there was nobody who would question on her. She was the Lingdao, she was the leader. Nobody could question her, and nobody would. She invited the creators from the US, these corrupt soda scientists, to China and introduced them as the top scientists in the world. So there was no way to challenge soda science. And so it offers a question that I think is really interesting. It's possible, and I would love listeners to think about this, and perhaps their data can address this question. It's possible that Chinese scientists, because they're accustomed to the existence of a single party defined truth in many areas of their life, that they will easily accept the idea that there's one best science, especially when the person telling them that is a party official and the leader of a certain body of scientific research. So I find that very interesting. The contrast is so sharp. And it tells us something new about Chinese science that I don't think people had thought too much about before.
I totally agree with you here that there should be more research on this topic. Your book looks into the entanglement of scientific knowledge production, corporate interests, and politics, especially in the China part. You talk about politics with a capital P. What were the biggest challenges when you conducted research on such a sensitive topic? How do you explain the convergence between corporate interests and government policies in China?
Let me talk about the way I discovered that. I actually talk about capital P in China, politics as in party politics, regime politics. When I was so, I, the methodology that I used for this study is actually quite similar to the one that I innovated in Just One Child. So we all want to know what top party leaders are thinking, and even the political scientists don't get access to them. But my thought was, since top party leaders have declared science the source of truth and modern thought in China, then the party leaders are really leaning on the scientists. So they also require that all policy be made, quote, scientifically. And so my thought was, if you really get to know the scientists very well, especially those who were most influential within the regime, within policy making, then they can reveal things about the policy process and leaders, top leaders, that you would otherwise not know. And in the one-child policy research, I had spent so long talking to so many scientists. Finally, I learned some things, very, very interesting stories, really funny stories about the top leaders and what they did when they disagreed with them. So in this case, I also worked through these scientists to learn what happened at the science-making level. But in this case, what was interesting is the scientist that I studied, Chen Shunling, was also a policymaker herself. So she told me exactly how the policy was made. And it was easy for her to do that because she was at the center of the process. For example, in creating the guidelines for obesity, she first sent a memo to the Ministry of Health saying, "Obesity is becoming a terrible problem in China. We need guidelines on its management and treatment." So the ministry says, "Oh, we need guidelines. Please make them." And so then Chen Shunling and her group make them, and then circulate them around, revise them, send it back to the ministry. They went back and forth on a number of revisions, and then the ministry accepted it and published it as a ministry document with nothing said about the group that actually made it. So the two policies that this group made were both made that way, in a bottom-up way, with total participation by the scientists involved. So the challenge for a researcher is not really the challenge of access. You can gain access to the scientists. But the challenge is that we, as anthropologists, we have to be really familiar with the context so that we can interpret what we learn. We need to be familiar with the dynamics of Chinese statecraft when it comes to science making and policy making. We need to collect all sorts of other materials, like policies and internal histories of the field to triangulate our data. But there are great ways of getting at these questions.
Well, that's actually a really brilliant way to do policy research, to start from the scientists, not from government officials. Among all the materials you have gathered during your research, but did not include in the book, can you share with us some of the materials that you would have liked to include in the book, but for various reasons could not?
Well, to tell the truth, of all the materials that I gathered, I probably used about 10% in the book. There's so much wonderful stuff going on that I couldn't possibly include. What I had to do is, because in this book, it's kind of like a forensic anthropology, I'm making really major claims against Coca-Cola, against that scientific nonprofit, ILSI, and against the scientists involved. And I felt it was really important to make sure that I had a compelling evidence to support all those claims. So I had to tell a very tight story about this corruption and then how it was hidden and then how the corrupt science got built into the policy. So I had to leave out a lot. Some of the material that I thought was so fun, but I couldn't include, was a lot of those emails between Coca-Cola's chief science officer and the academic scientists based in universities around the country. Lots of great material there because, of course, they had no idea anybody would be reading their emails years later. Also, I interviewed 12 global specialists on obesity science and policy, just to get their take on what was going on in China. They told me so much, just like 3 hour interviews. I could only use, say, like one sentence from each of these people. Hundreds of articles by the soda scientists. If I had time, I would go through those and pull out ways the knowledge was actually corrupted. But I'd say, with about, what, 350 pages, it's probably enough material.
Susan, can I just ask a question as well regarding this? Did you ever feel threatened throughout the process of doing research? I mean, given the seriousness of some of the claims, as you were saying, against Coca-Cola, did you ever feel threatened in any way?
As a matter of fact, yes. When I was in China, there was no threat at all. Everybody kept saying, "Why are you wasting your time studying obesity? This is such a trivial problem." Although, when you talk to the specialists there, they were very agitated when I got into sensitive questions like corporate influence. But I did feel seriously threatened. Back in 2019, I published two articles simultaneously. One of them was in the BMJ, the British Medical Journal. It was like the first outing of my main findings. It showed, through journalistic interpretation, it showed how Koch's involvement in China had shifted China's policy toward exercise over diet. And that was coming out in early 2019. Family, friends, a lot of people said, "Susan, you are going to be under the radar of Coca-Cola. You had better watch out." And I was particularly nervous because an article had come out recently showing that public health scientists in Mexico who were supporting Mexico's soda tax had found all this malware on their phones. Their phones were totally messed up. They couldn't get in touch with each other. They couldn't get in touch with the Ministry of Health. And so it became obvious it was very easy for these companies to intervene in our lives and make life difficult. And so I called my university to see if they would provide legal help if I were sued. And the answer was no. The answer was no, sorry, faculty choose their own topics. So I was incredibly anxious when those articles came out. Fortunately, Koch's attitude was, "No problem, we agree, sugar is bad, we've changed our policy." So yes, it was quite unnerving at certain points.
This is critical anthropology at its best, and what a courageous decision that was. Do you think that your book is going to have a positive impact on shifting the direction of public policy on obesity?
In China?
In the US and China, in the world globally, I would say, yes.
I would hope so. That might take a while. But what I've done is the public health people who are critical of these kinds of shenanigans, they just point to one example and say, that's terrible. Whereas what I've done, I have deep, 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 deep. I document every step in the corruption of science. So there's no place for anybody to hide. I think it will take a while for the impact of this style of research, which is very anthropological, to get through to the decision makers. What I would hope is that it would accelerate the time when China gets serious about taxing and regulating soda.
Thank you very much for joining us here at TechnoViews, Susan. You are listening to Professor Susan Greenhalgh talking about her book, Soda Science: Making the World Safe for Coca-Cola, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2024. This is an episode of TechnoViews, a new online platform broadcasting interviews with major humanities and social science scholars on topics at the intersection between science, technology and society in the 21st century. TechnoViews is available on all major podcast platforms worldwide, as well as in the YouTube channel of the SciTech Asia International Research Network. Please check our website, sciTechAsia.org, to sign up for our newsletter, and please visit our social media in Facebook, Instagram, and WeChat to keep updated with our latest events.